enough, we find in Merodach a new dimension coming in, because this is the God who kills himself and still lives, who tortures himself but cannot die, and who has an internal and an eternal existence apart from his external and temporal one. In order to achieve his purpose, Merodach decapitates himself. He cuts off his own head, and he then takes the blood that pours from the severed arteries, he mingles it with the forms that he has fashioned out of the body of the dragon. And therefore, having placed his own nature within these forms, he supplies in this way a link with his own spiritual source. For having received into themselves the blood of the God, the forms are then capable of being ensouled, and the deities come down across the road of blood, or the road of the first sacrifice, and take upon themselves these bodies. And thus it is that men, or mankind, comes into existence. For mankind comes in as the result of mind being locked in body by a mystery of sacrifice. In this point also, we have to go into the Babylonian theology and their system of mysteries, which were developed at a considerably later date. For we observe then in this concept that mind is immersed or absorbed in body, or that life and reason, like the Dionysus of the Greeks, is sacrificed in order that humanity may come into existence. To make possible, therefore, the individualization of mankind, universal mind and reason become buried or absorbed into form, and thereby increase this form, giving it an indwelling rationality, and setting up in the middle distances between spirit and matter the great world of form over which mind rules supreme. Form is matter plus organization or archetype. And all forms are compounds. And compounds are only possible because mind holds together the elements or substances of matter. If therefore in death the conscious being is separated from the body disintegrates. Because it is the dweller in the body that maintains and preserves the compound. This compound is form, and forms are therefore embodied, are ensouled bodies. For wherever there is a body that is ensouled, it is a compound of life and matter, and as such, it has an internal existence in eternity and an external existence in time. The internal existence in eternity is derived from the God Eos. The temporal existence in time is derived from the sacrifice of Merodach. And in the combination of these two, we have the beginning of the Babylonian concept of the nature of man himself, and why man gradually becomes the master of and conqueror of the world. For out of the form principle emerges the hero of the world. This then brings us to a point in the Babylonian cosmogony, and now we have to pause and go back and strike a second stream, because there were two streams of this, as I told you, one of which ends or terminates in the broken tablets in which Merodach has brought forth and organized his kingdom and has become the archetype of the ruler, the archetype of the egoic self that is born of the compound of time and eternity, of this and abyss, of life and death. The story of how all this happened, the ancient records that go back to the very earliest period, are said to have been given to the people of this region by Oannes, the fishman, or the Dagon, the mysterious being who came out of the sea and who is certainly and definitely a form of Baal Marduk. This being, however, carries with it certain other mysterious attributes. The sea, as we have already suggested here, is one of the attributes of this being, Ea, because Ea was not only the creator god, but primordially a water deity. The mysterious waters of space, the Shamayim of the ancient Hebrew, the waters which were above the firmament of Genesis, were the waters from which Ea came. Now, Oannes comes out of the sea also. And here we must study once more the nature of water in the symbolism of these people. Water is the symbol of generation, as we said before. It is the symbol also of imagination, because it is ruled by sin, which is a capital S, which is not a vice, but is the name of the Babylonian moon god. And this deity is the controller of the waters of the earth. Sin and the moon, and perhaps sin and imagination, may have curious relationships to each other, even in our more modern way of thinking. But Oannes comes out of the sea, and he comes with the body of a fish, the great fish. And he is covered with scales, and beneath the head of the fish is a human face. And the head of the fish is above it, forming what we commonly know as the bishop's mitre. And the bishop's mitre is also the fish head because of its association in Christianity. Oannes, or Dagon, never eats while upon the land. Remains upon the land all day and goes back to the sea every night. This wonderful deity, or wonderful being, was the one who brought forth the civilization of these people. He gave them the great rudiments of culture. He taught them all things, and then every night returned to the sea. And he would never take any part in any earthy thing, and he would never reveal his true identity to anyone. He simply told them that they were his chosen people, and that he was there to give them the rudiments of knowledge. So he taught them reading and writing and mathematics and architecture and husbandry and chemistry and medicine and law. He taught them astronomy and how to judge the seasons. He gave them a priesthood and a theology. And he was a psychopomp, or a lord of souls. And after he had given them all wisdom and all knowledge, he returned to the sea, leaving behind him a priesthood, which was to carry on his rites and his mysteries. Now this Dagon, who comes out of the great water of imagination, out of the great mystery, is of course the eternal teacher, the mysterious guardian, the great and eternal ancient, which does certainly come out of man's own inner life. Now the Babylonians associated the appearance of this deity with day, and that when night came, he retired again to the sea. So he obviously becomes a symbol of certain rational attributes of man, which function during the daytime and become quiescent or return to the unknown at night. So this hero, this great guardian of all things, like Persephone, who spends half her time in the underworld and half in the world of light, is one of the numerous equations and symbols to represent a part of human egoism. That part which objectively integrates worlds and subjectively disappears into its own cause in sleep. So Oannes becomes the symbol of the teacher, another phase of the emergence of self. But in the beginning, he came from the great sea, which has to be the human unconscious. And is another example of man's source of knowledge arising from the subtle, invisible, and mysterious parts of his own subjective nature. Now this being also established the mysteries and gave to the people a version of the story of Merodach and the dragon. And this being taught them that they were to keep its rules and keep its laws and keep its covenants, and that in the fullness of time, in the last great day, this being would return and would again rule over his people unto everlastingness. And that this would be the restoration of the golden age and the fulfillment of all good things. This can only and must only be interpreted to represent the gradual restoration of total consciousness in man and its ultimate re-establishment as the controlling power in human life. Now, religion was set up among the Babylonians as a means of doing honor and of keeping the laws given by Oannes or Dagon. And in the ritual, the god was called upon and asked to help his people, to be available to them, to protect them and preserve them from their enemies, to give them the necessary laws and prepare them for the day of his own return. Now let us think a little tiny bit about this also. Because we have a priesthood established for the purpose of serving this invisible and unknown deity who had returned to the sea. And when we understand the purposes and meanings of the ancient priesthood and their ritualistic dramas, their instructions, and all of their teachings, we find that they were the custodians of processes and methods of human development and discipline, very similar to the yogic exercises of India. In other words, they were the custodians of a science of the release of the divine in man. This can only mean that it was through such release that they served Dagon, or Oannes, and that this Oannes represented the power in man which had to be released. That through the service of this and obedience to the laws of this power, man gradually came to understand it. And when he released it fully through himself, the second coming or the avatar had occurred, and the individual had entered into the golden age of conscious identification with his own spiritual nature. There is every obvious evidence in the myth that these facts and these principles were very well known to the Babylonian peoples. The goddess Ishtar occupies a very interesting and important relation to this entire cycle. Like most comparative religious groups, the Babylonians had various deities ruling over different cities. And as time went on, these community deities gained separate mythological identity, became mixed and involved together, like in Greece, where Pallas Athena became the patroness of Athens, and so on. And the different deities were worshipped in their cities and had their own priesthoods. But there were certain common agreements among them, and Merodach, under one of the other of his names, was almost universally venerated. The goddess Ishtar whose name literally means a star or constellational brilliance, was originally, apparently, a war goddess. She was much associated with military activity and was armed like Pallas Athena. In many respects, she is similar to Athena because she represents also the higher or intuitive or feminine aspect of mind or reason on its intuitional basis. Ishtar occurs late in the mythological story of these people in her descent into the underworld to rescue Tammuz, her beloved lover, who had died and had been taken to the underworld. And it was her desire to rescue him and bring him forth again into light, almost a reversal of the Orpheus and Eurydice cycle in Greece and the Pluto and Persephone. Because in the case of the Babylonian, it was the hero and not the heroine who had descended into the underworld. Ishtar, to rescue Tammuz, passes through the seven gates that leads downward to the abode of sin, or the god of the moon and death. And here, deprived of her royal robes and adornments, she seeks to achieve the restoration of Tammuz, to bring him back again to the upper world. Unfortunately, the records of the fable are incomplete. The outcome is not known. Obviously, the fable belonged to the initiation rituals and therefore was not committed in its fullness to writing, much as in the case of Isis wandering the earth in search of the dismembered body of Osiris, her lord. Ishtar becomes again now a symbol of the psychic life of man, and again is involved in this mystery of creation. For we have now three different levels, or three different stories that are important to us. One is the creation of the universe by the power of Merodach. The second is the creation of man, primarily, and the unfoldment of man's life through parts of the Merodach story and the Oannes cycle. And the third is the mystery of the human soul, represented in the myth or legend of Ishtar. So man, spirit, mind and soul, or spirit, body and soul, is involved in these three great cycles of mythology. The Babylonians also recognized the soul equation in their religious teaching and were among the first to set forth this concept almost exactly as it later occurs in the religious writings of the Semitic peoples. For in this concept, the soul, which is rescued, represents something that is brought into existence and which is first of all sacrificed for the good of the ego or the self, and later becomes the redeemer of it. So the psychic life of man is first of all his internal life, which restores his external life. And also, the soul is actually the experience which man has inwardly accumulated. Experience is something that nothing can bestow except through the long and difficult process of growth. Therefore, the soul cannot be given to man. It must be earned. But the soul, in turn, becomes the redeemer of the personality. And Ishtar, descending through the seven gates, representing the seven sensory levels of man and the seven degrees of material existence, finally rescues man from materialism, which is the symbol of death. So man's psychic nature gradually created within him, as explained in the Old Testament in the creation of Eve. The psychic life of man becomes his redeemer, and like Pallas Athena, is born fully armed from the head of Zeus. For the whole evolutionary process of man is the perfection of qualities within his consciousness, qualities which gradually come to have an existence of their own. So in the Babylonian and in the Greek, and to a great degree in the Chinese, where it is a very commonly taught doctrine, we find the creation of the alchemical homunculus, or the artificial human being, the positive polarity of the negative concept of the Frankenstein. Now, man has always played with the idea of manufacturing or creating artificial beings. He had toyed with the concept that sometime he could create life. He doesn't know it, but this is a psychic statement of a fact. Man does create life, because man as a living creature is creating his own soul, which is an artificial living thing, to which he is capable of bestowing life. When he bestows life, he plays the part of Merodach, for he gives of himself to preserve or protect the life of his own soul. This, of course, is preserved in the era of chivalry, in the legends of the knight going forth to defend the damsel in distress, and if necessary, giving his life to protect her honor. And each human being, at one time in his evolution, must give his life to protect the honor of his soul. This is because the psychic life within him is the alchemical product which all other things are involved in the perfection of and the completion of its part in man's nature. Thus we have it as the philosopher's stone in alchemy, the stone that is produced from the blending of the three mysteries of salt, sulfur, and mercury. Salt in this particular case is Ishtar. Sulfur in this particular case represents the gods, or the great spiritual power, which is Merodach. And Mercury is again the messenger of the gods, Zoroanes, the fish man. Because Mercury is also Votan, or Odin, and Mercury is always the teacher, the messenger of the gods. Mercury is therefore the solvent, likewise, in the nature of man. The soul is born out of experience. It has its abode in the psychic life of the individual. Man, prior to the integration of consciousness, like the fabled Adam, had a demon wife, Lilith, that represents the soul of chaos. In other words, the psychic experience of chaos, the negative soul. In growth and development, this soul is gradually transformed, and from it in time, as from Mary of Magdala, are cast forth the seven demons. And the seven demons are found in the description of the Pymander of Hermes also, and the seven levels of purification in which the soul has to pass. And here we have the seven cardinal virtues and the seven deadly sins of theology. For these sins refer to the negative powers of the soul. Through experience, therefore, the soul or psychic life of man is the magnificent result of individuality. Individuality in itself is of no merit. Man can go on forever being wiser and wiser, but he'll never get anywhere. Because the mere fulfillment of all these material things will never bring the conclusion of life. Man does not grow simply by experience, but experience makes growth possible. Growth results from contemplation of experience, from the uniting of an inner and outer receptivity. Through the soul, man begins to develop characteristics and character. And we have character, as morality, and as ethics, both individual and collective, as the result of the gradual release of soul power. And this soul power becomes, as it were, the saving grace. And out of the soul, according to the Chinese, is ultimately formed the transcendent being, who is, of course, to become the ultimate body of man. Because ultimately, man's physical body will no longer be his instrument. He will function in a soul structure, or an experience body, resulting from the gradual generation of psychic life within himself, until his psychic life is strong enough to sustain him. And he will function in that, rather than in a material body. The constant increasing intensity of man's psychic life is therefore more and more important and noticeable. And the restoration of this psychic life, the rescuing of it from appetites and desires, all this is very important. And all this is contained symbolically in the story of how these deities come into existence, and how once they are created, they then turn and become the preservers and saviors of the creation itself. So Tammuz as the personality, or the mortality in man, must be redeemed by Ishtar, who must descend through the seven worlds and rescue man from the limitation of his own mortality and return him again to the level of the divine world, or the divine experience from which he came. This is done through spiritual growth, for that which is caused to grow, or the spiritual inner conviction life of man, which becomes ultimately his teacher, and is, of course, another form of the goddess Isis, becomes his legitimate and proper mistress, whom he serves as the troubadour served his beloved. And this is also the beloved of the dervish and the Sufi mystic, the symbol of the psychic life within man, which must be served, which must ultimately become the leader of life. And this philosophy all developed in the area around the valley of the Euphrates, and has had a very heavy part to play in the thinking of these people for a very, very long time. Now, in the general concept, then, let's try to briefly, if we can, organize some of this pattern in terms of comparative creation myths, in order to get some kind of an integration that we can remember and carry from one level of circumstance to another. First, then, all creation myths begin with the uncreated. And this uncreate, according to the nature of the myths, exists in one of three kinds or qualities. This uncreate can be matter, and the universe can be an emergence by generation from matter. The uncreate can be mind, and as mind, the universe becomes the extension of this mental energy into various conditions. Modern man, looking for a creative solution which is non-theological, has hit upon the concept of universal mind. But universal mind, as a cosmic fact, can be the second level or layer from which a creation can emerge. The third and highest is universal spirit, which assumes a divine nature. Those who believe that the universe emerged from a universal spirit are essentially theologians. Those who believe that it began in a universal reason, or a universal mind, or a universal thought, are essentially philosophers. Those who believe that it originated in a universal substance or energy are essentially scientists. Now, in the older accounts, especially one like the Babylonian, the creation takes place on all three levels. So that all three theories are essentially true but not complete. Because there is a threefold creation that must be brought forth. There must be a creation of form, a creation of life, and a creation of mind. The creation of life, in the sense of its manifestation, opens the Babylonian theory. eternal life is not create, but the manifestation of life is. So the objectification of life as a spiritual force at the root of existences becomes the beginning of the ancient concept. The emergence of a universal matter, a form, a polarity of this. Life opposed as absolute activity by absolute inertia. The absolute dynamic and static, light and darkness, life and death, as polarities, were envisioned by most ancient peoples, and certainly were by the Babylonians. So the universal manifestation of life resulted in a universal generation on the level of matter. Spirit and matter both grow. And they grow because of laws inherent within them. The life of the growth of spirit is emergence. In other words, spirit grows by emerging, by moving from an unmanifest to a manifest condition. And as according to the Gnostic emanationism, the moment the life or spirit begins to move, there is a corresponding reaction from matter below. If spirit makes one step downward, matter makes one step upward. Every motion of spirit results in a reaction in matter. Because this motion becomes the absolute law of matter, and matter must inevitably abide by the motion of life. So whatever qualitative or quantitative motion, especially qualitative, life makes, form or matter must answer. Thus, when life is chaotic, matter is chaotic. When life integrates, matter integrates. And by degrees, these two, operating upon each other, cause a descent of life and an ascent of matter. The ascent of matter results in the individualization of monsters. Because matter, like body, as the Greeks pointed out, has its own intelligence, but it is purely and completely a material or survival intelligence. Body without consciousness has certain life intelligence within it. But that life intelligence is much lower and inadequate to the rational needs of man. Therefore, the law of matter in the creation of structure is merely mere growth, without moral reaction. Growth without control led to the great monsters, and even to the prehistoric creatures like the dinosaur and the megatherium and all the brontosaurs and things that we remember or hear about in the stories of ancient times, even on a scientific level. But these forms run riot were due to the lack of the principle of conscious control. And the moment forms come under the control of reason, they diminish in size and begin to integrate. Now, as life descending reached a certain point, and matter ascending reached a certain point, these two simple substances had to meet. And they met through the manifestation of the deity who represents always the second logos. And the second logos is always between the extremes and is always crucified between the opposites, because its great purpose is mediation. Its great problem is the reconciling of things, as in the case of Mercury, which must absorb the two opposite elements to create the philosopher's stone. So the central deity is always messianic. In the Greek triad, the one, the beautiful, and the good. The one, of course, is spirit, the good is matter, and the beautiful, which is art, is soul or mind, or the combination of these. And as beauty must bring order and harmony, and has virtue and integrity as elements of its own composition, So that which is created in strength is perfected in beauty. And the three great pillars of the house are wisdom, strength, and beauty. The alchemist said, art perfects nature. Beauty is art. The supreme art is human regeneration. But art is always a growth or a learning for the purpose of the service of the beautiful. And in the philosophical worlds, man becomes the handmaiden or the artist who helps nature to perfect its own works. Thus art, beauty, psyche, or the soul comes in between and becomes the reconciler, the redeemer, or the sacrificer. Now, wherever mind enters into the compound, or wherever form is compounded, we have a loss of values. We have this loss of values in the same way that we have a second theology when Merodach comes along, or still another theology when Oannes appears, and still another level of theology when Ishtar appears. Because all of these compoundings in the nature and structure of substances result in various obscurations and bring in new levels of function and attainment. When the universal reason or mind or the universal sota, the Messiah, takes upon itself the problem of reconciling spirit and matter in the creation of form, or in the equilibrium or balancing of form, it therefore sacrifices itself. It is immersed or buried in form. It takes upon itself the body of the world. It is crucified. It dies, and from its blood comes the salvation of men. So from the blood of Merodach was created the possibility of man's better way of life. Merodach, of course, appears again as Oannes, the teacher. And later the cycle is perfected by Ishtar, the soul, because all teaching must lead to the development of the soul nature. And the soul becomes the internal teacher. It is the teacher which speaks from experience or from the gradual accumulation of psychic life within man. The chemistry, then, of Merodach, or the hero self, sacrificing as the Messiah its own nature and becoming immersed in matter, produces man's power to become a creating psychic being capable of molding, regenerating, perfecting its own nature. It is no longer left as an instrument of the gods, because the gods have now taken up their abode within it. And the indwelling God makes man capable of the God experience in himself. So Merodach's sacrifice was necessary, like that of Dionysus, in order that man might have within himself the spark of divinity by which alone he could ever know divinity. So man becomes the tomb, the holy sepulcher of this mysterious martyred God. And this martyred God, buried in the sepulcher of the body, as Plato so well points out, the body is the sepulcher of the soul, becomes Tammuz, buried in the seventh layer of the underworld, from which he must be rescued by his own soul, or by the soul power of nature. Now, the soul power of nature is manifested through the seven arts, through the entire development of man's conscious life, for all of his conscious effort, his effort at growth, his effort at empire building, his effort at perfecting his own nature, his desire to be good, to be beautiful, to be strong, to be wise. All of these are the psychic power within him, leading him on to the rescue of his own buried self. So that the psychic emergency of sorrow, pain, stress, all of this is part of the power which relieves or releases man from the sepulcher of his own ignorance or mortality. Through the psychic life, man is building the bridge or the ladder which leads him back again to his own spiritual origin. The laws of this way, of this path, were given by Oannes, or by a further reappearance of the Messiah, who must not only inhabit and take up life, but must also give the teaching by which this life can be released. So the service of the mysteries, as they were practiced, these mysteries were dedicated to the restoration and resurrection of the dying God. And of course, we have in this story another example of the dying God symbolism. Now, in modern time, in modern thinking, is there anything here that means much to us? Or are these myths truly only dated fragments of an ancient time? I think they mean a great deal to us, because mythology is an eternal record of man's psychic life. And by mythology, man is always and forever seeking to explain himself. Just as he has never been able to find, literally and physically, a good explanation for how the universe came into being, he doesn't have easily available any good explanation for why he came into being, or how he came into being, or what he came into being to do. He must therefore always face this mythological mystery, which is nothing more or less than the effort to solve instinctively the problem of his own existence. And in the Babylonian or in any other system, we have a splendid opportunity to become aware of our own subjective lives and what these lives may mean to us. Obviously, we came out of our own subjective. Obviously, all of these systems are egocentric. They begin with man. They begin with man's reaction to that from which he came and to that to which he came. Man, in the poem, you know, came out of the everywhere into the here. Very mysterious. A charming statement, but requiring considerable commentary. Man also finds himself in the here. And primitive man, as we can imagine from surviving documentary evidence and artifacts, lived in a chaos which he knew very little about. So he lived in a universe that was too big for him and frightened him to death from the first moment he was in it. So he came from the unknown and he lived in the unknown. And he was confronted with two problems. Orientation to the outside world, which he had just entered, and orientation to an inside world which he knew nothing about. He was therefore truly crucified between the two unknowns. He has been that way ever since. But technically, man today is still in much of a dilemma as to what's inside of him and what it means, what is outside of him and what it means. He is unable to balance or achieve an equilibrium between internal and external. And of course, the only possibility of achieving this equilibrium is through this integration which he calls selfhood. Now, in Buddhism, we know that the self is not an eternal thing, but the self is a focal point. And ourselves, or the ego as we know it today, is the living testimony of the equilibrium we have attained between the internal and the external. We have built civilizations, we have created worlds, we've gone to school, we've done many things, we've invented and devised. And it is all as the result of gradually coming to equilibrium in the middle distance between the two unknowns. But today we are not sure what direction we are supposed to go. We are not sure of the direction from which we have come. All we know is that there is a tremendous potential inside of us and behind us. There is also a tremendous reactive outside of us and around us. Little by little, we are beginning to realize that this outside reactive is due almost exclusively to the internal pressure, and that creation is therefore a motion from the internal parts of things, and this motion setting up the objective reaction, so that we come to the point of emanationism, which I think has great psychological importance. When man internally steps down one step, the universe outside of him steps up one step to meet him. Any change that occurs within him must immediately produce a corresponding modification in his entire environment. So that if man, in the search for understanding, descends, then he may experience. Matter ascends and releases experience, or gives to him that which it contains, and which is really only a mirror. Because matter is forever mirroring the individual who is behind and invisible. Man cannot see himself, because he does not possess the direct power of looking in. The only way man can see himself, as Bacon pointed out, is to hold the mirror of nature before his face. Then he sees his reflection, but he cannot see his actual nature. So he has to depend upon knowing himself through the reflection of himself upon his environment. Now this environment is the chaos, and in this environment also is the dragon who has to be slain. And man is the dragon slayer who must overcome this chaos. But he must recognize that the chaos on the outside is only a symbol of the chaos on the inside. And what we call evil is nothing but the reflection of immaturity. It is lack of adequate integration within. Any negative thing which we see around us is due to an undeveloped power within our natures. And any divine and positive thing that we see is due to an objectified power within our own natures, which has been brought to maturity, or at least to a reasonable degree of growth. The entire theory of creation, as it is developed in this great cycle of probably 30 or 40 nations, is therefore this struggle in which man ultimately achieves his true position as master of the polarities by simply recognizing that the external is nothing but the shadow of his own immaturity. Therefore, that he must cure the external by correcting the internal. And that the moment he integrates inwardly, the material pattern falls into its proper place. Thus, the involutionary program is that in which life gradually descends into a state of obscurity. Evolution is man's release of this life from obscurity in matter to the restatement of its own essential nature. And this release, this evolutionary process, is nothing more or less than ideation. It is not man actually climbing up. It is man building psychic or soul power within himself, which causes the world around him to change from a material to a psychic thing. Evolution is the power of man's soul over his environment. And whatever change or transition occurs in the psychic life, the material environment takes its place. A good example of that is the very simple fact that as soon as man is a self-governing creature inside, we will have peace in the world as far as politics are concerned. Because politics, again, is nothing but the lengthening shadow of man. This is a large composite thing. But in imagination, in psychic life, in psychotherapy, in all the illusions and delusions which burden the individual, in every degree of these things, we have the same cosmological scheme of the conquest of illusion by reality, the slaying of the dragon, or the integrated normal power of the psychic life victorious over chaos. And every individual who is not ordered is living in a chaos. And the only way that he can bring cosmos out of this chaos is to restore or rescue his own internal, which he does by following the rituals of the mysteries. And by learning through the study of the creation cycle, how he and his problem came into existence. For once he has discovered the nature of the problem, he is already well on the way toward its solution. And we will take up some other phases of the solution as we go along.